I'm glad you're joining me again in the book of Genesis, where we are in chapter number 9, which is the end of the flood story. We're in verse number 20, where we see a description of the restart of vineyards, of vinecrafting. I suggest to you that one of the things that Noah and his family did as they loaded up the ark was that they kept some certain plant rootstocks to be able to reestablish quickly some of the agricultural focal points of the old earth into the new earth. So plant stock from earth 2.0 earth. And so Noah, we are told, verse 20, began to be a man of the soil. He is a farmer. He is an agricultural person. And he planted a vineyard. So he puts the vines in the ground and begins to cultivate them. Now, I already shared with you that by Jewish legal standards that come up later in the books of Moses, you're not supposed to mess with the vines until year number 4. That's the first year that you're allowed, after having established the rootstock in the ground, to clip it, clip the fruit off, and process it into juice. Now let's talk about that. When you take the grapes and you crush them and get the juice off of them, you also have included in that juice some of the microbial things that were on the outside of the grape that are going to feed upon the sugars. And one of the byproducts of this microbial life is alcohol. Now, in natural fermentation, the alcohol content will eventually reach a, you know, 2-3% of the full volume, and this tends to stabilize the liquid at that point. It doesn't allow it to become any more alcoholic, but it also keeps it stabilized for a longer period of time. It basically preserves it. And so this is the whole helpfulness of wine. That sort of low alcohol, you would have to drink an awful lot of it, it would seem, in order to get drunk. Now, what we read here in the scripture is that Noah drank of that first vintage, apparently, and he became drunk. So it couldn't have been just grape juice that he was drinking, because you don't get drunk off grape juice. You only get drunk off of a good amount of wine that you're doing. So he drinks enough of it that he loses a little bit of his inhibitions and apparently passes out, I guess is the best way of saying that, without his proper clothing on in his tent. Now, why? Why did he get drunk? Now, I've heard some people and read some people suggest that he was feeling really depressed about the destruction of the planet and all the death that had happened and how he and his family are the only ones left. So kind of a sort of survivor's guilt complex here. And so because he's in this state, he drinks himself into oblivion. Well, I just can't quite get myself on board with that. I mean, as I already shared with you, it's more than likely 4 years later that this whole story is coming up. So why? Why would he do it then? I would offer to you an alternative, and I've seen this in some creationist material. The atmosphere and the environment of planet Earth was completely different before the flood. There's some indication that the pressure was higher, the oxygen content was higher, and therefore the plants would have been different. And if you made wine out of the plants previous to the flood, that wine would have followed perhaps a different course of fermentation, and drinking it, your body might have metabolized it differently in a in an environment where there's higher oxygen content and higher atmospheric pressure. And so it could be that Noah, drinking this first vintage, and apparently drinking it in plenty, was not prepared for the new effect that this wine would have on his body in this new world, and that this was completely an accident. And I believe that that's the case. Now, what happens, though, while he's passed out, is the true problem in this story. It says in verse 22 that Ham, the son of Canaan, the father of Canaan. Now remember that Canaan is perhaps a little bitty baby at this time because the babies are starting to be born in the New World. But Canaan is the namesake of the sinful people groups living in Canaan, the promised land, where the first readers of the book of Genesis are going, and where they're being told by God, the sins of the Canaanites are so bad, I'm going to kick them out and give you their land. I'm going to dispossess them because of their sin and give you their land. And so, for the readers of the book of Genesis, their immediate connection here is, oh, this is the story of the origin of the Canaanites. And so there's going to be a curse related to that line that the Israeli people will apply to themselves and their interaction with the Canaanites. So verse 22 again. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. So Ham goes into the tent, sees dad naked. Now, dad is like 600, just over 600 years of age. Ham is right around 100. So he's still a relatively young man. And his father should be respected. And so he goes outside and starts talking to Shem and Japheth about their father's shameful situation. And apparently, he's making fun of it. He's laughing about it and mocking his father. There's going to be even some suggestion that he may have done something to his father to make it even more shameful. And that this is going to be the beginning of this first curse in the new world. Verse 23, this is the response of the other two brothers. Then Shem and Japheth took a garment. They laid it on both their shoulders, and they walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. So these two brothers, having heard dad is laying inappropriately uncovered in the tent, they get some covering for him, and they walk into the tent very studiously, very carefully, avoiding looking at their father's embarrassing nakedness. And they walk backward until they can cover his nakedness with this covering. So they are acting as their father's protectors, while Ham acted as his father's mocker. Their faces were turned backward, and they did not see their father's nakedness. When Noah awoke from his wine, that is, when he got over his drunk, when he recovered his senses, and he knew what his youngest son had done to him. So more than likely, either Shem and Japheth explained to him what had happened while he was drunk and unclothed, or God revealed it to him. And this is my opinion, and that's all it's worth for you. I am more of the mindset that God revealed to him the mockery that had been done at his expense while he was passed out by Ham. And that God also, at that same time, told Noah what lay in the future for this particular genetic line. And that is the source of the prophecy that comes up next. Because Noah is counted as the first prophet of the new world, of the post-flood world. So he said, "Cursed be Canaan. A servant of servants shall he be to his brothers." Now this is a... which is the cause and which is the effect sort of passage. Did this happen because Noah said it, or did Noah say it because it was going to happen? And I would go with the second of those two. Prophecy is an interesting thing. God knows the end from the beginning. God knows all the free will choices that are going to be taken throughout time. And so that is why he alone can say with specificity what will happen in the future. Now, that doesn't mean he makes it happen. He tells us it's going to happen because he knows what the future holds because of free will choices. One of the New Testament examples that I emphasize on this is that God did not make Judas betray Jesus. God knew that Judas would betray Jesus and used him in order to accomplish his own purposes. Because as Paul says in Romans, God is able to make all things work together for those who love God and who are called according to his purposes. So God is able to work everything out of our free will choices, even the worst ones, and turn them into something useful. So in this case, God apparently looked well ahead in time to the time of the Israelites that are reading this, that are under the leadership of Moses and Joshua, and says, this is what's going to happen. Canaan's descendants, Canaan's just a little bitty baby at this point, his descendants will end up in a cursed status, and they will end up being servants. A servant of servants is the ultimate servant to their brothers. A little bit more explanation comes up in the next part of the section. He also said, "Blessed be he who is the God of Shem." Now remember that he who is a new term in the time of Moses. In the time of Noah, it didn't exist. So Moses is putting it in place for whatever was being used at that time, probably El Elyon, God Most High, or El Shaddai, God of my chest, or the Almighty God. So the God of creation is to be blessed, and he is the God of Shem. He's also the God of Japheth in this story, because they apparently respect God and respect their father Noah. So blessed be he who is the God of Shem. Let Canaan be his servant. Some of the Canaanites, specifically I'm thinking about the Gibeonites at the center of what was the Promised Land. Some of the Canaanites didn't just simply run away when the Israelis came into the land and God was kind of dispossessing the Canaanites. Some of the Canaanites didn't end up killed because they wouldn't run away and tried to take a last stand like the people at Jericho did on their walls, and they also died. Some Canaanites, like the Gibeonites, feared this idea of the God of the Israelis, and they came up with a plan to make a deal to survive the coming of the Israelis with God Most High. And so the Gibeonites voluntarily became slaves or servants of the Israelis. And so that is what fulfills verse 26 here specifically. Now, why am I emphasizing that? Because we have some very foolish people living in the 1700s and 1800s here in the United States that tried to claim that this curse was actually placed upon black people, and that this gave the other people of the world the right to enslave them. And it just makes me so mad as a Bible teacher when that sort of twisting of God's inspired word is used to do immoral things. It just burns me up. I'm getting upset sitting here talking into the microphone. We need to reestablish the clear-cut meaning of these scriptures and call out the bad teaching, the false teaching of those that were trying to use scripture to cover up their own sins, because there was no excuse for the kidnapping and the enslavement and the breeding of Africans for the slave trade and the plantation enslavement that was going on all over the world, but particularly in the New World during the 15, 16, 1700s. I am so thankful that it finally ended in the 1800s. Never let anyone get away with using this section of the book of Genesis to excuse the slavery that was going on in the New World. Now, back to the text itself. So, blessed be he who is the God of Shem. Shem is where we get the word Semite. So the Israelis are going to be part of this gene group. And we'll actually start looking at the different gene groups here pretty quick. Let Canaan be his servant. That's the Gibeonites in particular that we're thinking about here. Verse 27, may God enlarge Japheth. Now, Japheth is the source pretty much of the European gene lines. There's a few that come from technically the Asia area, but Japheth tends to be the European groups. And it is that group that in particular starts embracing Christianity early on. And because of that, they embrace the Old Testament faith of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, which is at the root of the New Testament story. And so that's why it says here, may God enlarge Japheth and let him dwell in the tents of Shem. And so, yes, we have kind of connection between the Old Testament and the New Testament people here in this verse. And then let Canaan be his servant. And again, it is not about the African slave trade. The reality is that a lot of the people groups from the lower Middle East, the Canaanites, they end up being enslaved and shipped off to places where Japhethites live. And so they end up taking those people on as their slaves as well. And so that is the way that this passage is fulfilled. Now, the next big thing that we read here is about the death of Noah. Verse 28, after the flood, Noah lived 350 years, and all the days of Noah were 950, and he died. And so he is kind of the last long-lived, super long-lived of the human race. From here on out, we will see a rapid decline in the average lifespan. And more than likely, it is related to the change in Earth's environment. Noah lived 600 years in the pre-flood environment. And so he continues to attain to the average lifespan of pre-flood people. But Shem, Ham, and Japheth only lived 100 years in the pre-flood environment, and so they very quickly lose the long-lived lifespans of the pre-flood peoples. And Josephus is a good representative of the Jewish mindset on that, and that is that basically the food previous to the flood and the environment previous to the flood contributed to the long lives of the people before the flood. And as I think I already mentioned, there's evidence, scientific-based evidence, that the pre-flood world had a higher rate of oxygen or a higher concentration of oxygen in the environment. And we know that that helps in the regeneration process of the human body. Wounds heal lots faster in a high oxygen environment. We even do pressure chambers to help with this, because that's the other thing, is that there's evidence that before the flood, there was a higher atmospheric pressure, and that this also would have helped human beings attain to much longer lives. The plant life, and plants were the source of food previous to the flood. Plant life before the flood seems to have been much larger and probably more full of good nutrition. We know that we refer to many things as trace elements today because they are not easily found in the sedimentary layers that make up our Earth's soil now. They are found down in the bottom of the ocean, and they have to be brought back up and processed and put into vitamins and things like that. So we have good evidence that after the flood, nutrition was not as good, and the atmosphere was not as good. This also is going to combine with the fact that over time, the gene code is starting to deteriorate. The telomeres, which are at the ends of the chromosomes that have to reproduce each time a new cell is made, these telomeres get shorter and shorter each reproduction cycle. And that seems to have degraded even more after the flood as well. And so we will see eventually humanity settling down with kind of an upper limit of about 120 years, which is exactly what the Hebrew text indicated. But the average lifespan, as we find in Moses's only psalm in the book of Psalms, Psalm number 90, is 70 or 80 years. And so that's still kind of the norm in our modern society. Now, we've only got 2 minutes left. And so let me set the stage for what we're going to do next time we get together. Chapter number 10 has for a long time been referred to as the Table of Nations, or the Table of the Goyim. A Goyim, or the nation, is going to be a people group that has a shared genetic background. They will often have a shared language or dialect. They might even have shared physical features and even a shared area on planet Earth as their starting point. And so this is where we start getting our genetic groups after the flood. And the base ones are described here in chapter number 10 in the time of Moses, where they're located. We'll have a little bit of help from Josephus in identifying some of these people and where they're located. But they come from three base groups. Chapter 10, verse 1 says, "These are the generations," or the origin points, the beginnings, "of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And sons were born to them after the flood." And so we'll go through and we'll talk about the subdividing of the Japhethites, the subdividing of the Hamites, and the subdividing of the Shemites in quite a bit of detail the next time we get into God's inspired and written word.